Today's sponsors, privacy.com/ring. Privacy.com is a totally free service that lets you buy anything online without having to give out your credit card number. You just take a couple of minutes to link your bank account to your privacy.com account. Then you create virtual credit card numbers that you can use anywhere, which are linked to your bank account. Create as many virtual cards as you want with the ability to delete them and set limits so that you're not charged without your consent. It's great for signing up for free trials without the fear of being charged. You're totally protected from hackers because you're not giving out your real credit card number and your virtual card is locked to one merchant. And their mobile app and desktop browser extension make it easy to manage your wallet of virtual cards and autofill your virtual card number at the click of a button when shopping online. You can get 100% free and unlimited access by going to privacy.com/ring. Happy holidays. This is Sam Cedar from Ring of Fire Radio. It's a best of, and we will be back in 2019. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on the show, Dahlia Lithwick from Slate will join us to discuss Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court hearings this week. Progressive Radio host Bob Kincaid joins us to discuss the impeachment of 4 out of 5 West Virginia Supreme Court justices. Angelo Carasone from Media Matters will stop by to fill us in on more of the congressional hearings involving Facebook and Twitter. And Heather Digby-Parton from Salon will be here to break down all the big news stories from this busy week. Finally, Matt Brunig from the People's Policy Project will be here to explain what a social wealth fund for America might look like. Don't forget, you can go to ROFpodcast.com, sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show, commercial-free, become a member. That's the best way to support this show. That's ROFpodcast.com. Here to help me break down the biggest news stories of the past week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, let's start with the biggest story of the week. I think the one that's going to have the most implications, literally for decades to come. And we should say we're going to be talking the legal side of this a little bit later in the program with a guest who works on those issues. But I'm talking, of course, about the Brett Kavanaugh hearings that started this week with, could have the potential of locking in a 5-4 majority of really hardcore conservatives on the court. All of this coming with the backdrop, of course, of Merrick Garland and Barack Obama being denied even a hearing for over a year regarding his nominee. And, of course, the fact that the President of the United States is under investigation. Everyone around him is under investigation. There have been multiple indictments of people very close to him. A rather inauspicious way or situation for someone to make such dramatic changes to the country. Give me your initial thoughts. I mean, the first day started with the Democrats basically trying to argue none of this is appropriate on procedural grounds because they had not gotten the documents that anybody had requested, including Chuck Grassley, the Republican head of the committee. And to the extent that they did get documents, something like 40 some odd thousand showed up 12 hours before the hearing began.
Well, that's right. And in fact, it was there were fireworks in the beginning. I thought it was really quite interesting. Apparently, the Democrats decided to, work in tandem and make this point very clear that the process was tainted. And it has been. I mean, there's no doubt about it. They're trying to it's clear what's going on. They're trying to rush this through without doing a thorough investigation of Kavanaugh because he's a right-wing hack and has been his entire career. And a lot of what he said and done that they're trying to cover up that's not in the sort of official record, his record as a judge, is probably pretty horrible. I mean, he was part of the Bush administration at a time when they were doing torture. They were trying to, you know, kill Social Security. They were, you know, moving against gay marriage. I mean, he was in there right in the mix. He was writing about it. He was giving his opinion. And they don't want any of that to come out. So, in fact, when Dick Durbin, the senator from Illinois, came out and gave his first statement or one of his first statements, he actually held up a big poster that was very illustrative of what they're doing. Blacked out he had the dates of Kavanaugh's, you know, various production of documents. The blackout is completely during that period in the Bush administration, and it's very telling of what they're trying to cover up. And they're trying to cover up Kavanaugh's opinions on all these things that he is going to be ruling on as a Supreme Court justice. And these games that they're playing, like, you know, they've got some lawyer, his name is William Burke, I think, who is, you know, he also represents Don McGahn in the Mueller investigation and some other people involved in the Mueller investigation. But for some reason, they've allowed him to be the one to decide which documents are going to go to the committee.
Right.
He's just some lawyer. He's not a government employee. He's not an archivist. He has no authority. And all the Democrats were saying, you know, who is this guy? Why are we listening to him? But that's the type of thing. There were dozens of those examples. And the Democrats, actually, I thought, did a pretty good job of laying out this case against the process. I mean, they're kind of hamstrung in a lot of ways, and, you know, obviously in the minority and with the Republicans just, you know, moving like a freight train to try and get this thing through before the midterms, knowing
and
that
we should,
this is a big problem.
We should also, I should add, just remind people, there is no longer a filibuster. The filibuster for the Supreme Court, done away by Mitch McConnell and others. And so that is, you know, that is no longer an option. Prior to that, you had Harry Reid had gotten away with the filibuster for lower courts and for executive nominees because of the stonewalling during the Obama administration. And then McConnell took that a step further. So there is literally nothing for them to do at this point. I mean, other than at first, get all the Democrats to vote against them, right?
Right.
And
right. I mean, they have to do that much. On a political basis, their job is they have to hold the line with the Democrats. And you know, granted, it's not easy because we've got at least four of them who are up for election in red states where they're coming under tremendous pressure to vote for Kavanaugh. I mean, I think you've got Heidi Heitkamp, Joe Manchin.
Well, you've got McCaskill,
Joe Donnelly in Indiana,
and Doug Jones in Alabama. But let
right.
me ask you this. I mean, what form does that pressure take? Like, I mean, who really, where is that pressure coming from? I mean, I'm skeptical of that a little bit. I mean, it seems to me.
And we should be because, you know, there was an article that came out, I think it was on Tuesday, showing, yeah, it was at The Intercept, I think, showing that whatever this pressure where, they, you know, they've really got the grassroots up in arms over this and, they, you know, they've really worked the grassroots to put pressure on all these red state Dems, it's nonsense. It's not actually happening. There haven't been more calls. There haven't been demonstrations. There haven't been people going to their offices. None of the signs of a true grassroots uprising over this issue is actually out there. So this, you know, this may just be, you know, typical propaganda to try and make people think that this is happening and to try and put institutional pressure on the Heitkamp, you know, maybe
right.
financial pressure. I would guess that's maybe where some of it's coming. I mean, let's face facts. I mean, Kavanaugh, and no different really than Kennedy, who he's replacing, as Senator Whitehouse laid out very clearly in his first presentation, which I thought was very well done, was going over what he calls the Roberts Five, which includes Kennedy and will now include Kavanaugh, on all this corporate, you know, this absolute, you know, voting in favor of corporations over and over and over again. The statistics are absolutely mind-boggling. If anybody gets a chance to go look at White House's presentation, I think it's on Medium, you can find it. And he, you know, what he laid out was is that this corporate agenda is already there and has been for some time. I mean, this is the Roberts Court. And, you know, he's got Gorsuch to replace Scalia, who was with him all the way on this stuff. You know, they have Alito, they've got Thomas, they've got Roberts, they've got, and, you know, Kavanaugh will replace Kennedy. And all of that is already happening.
Right.
In where Kavanaugh is going to make the difference, of course, is on these social issues, these contentious social issues where Kennedy would often, you know, they'd broker some compromise or he'd find some way to sort of, you know, finesse it and would vote on those issues. But on this corporate stuff, it's done. It's happening and it's been happening.
And I think there's one other area, and of course we'll get into this later in the program, but I think we can anticipate Kavanaugh to really inhibit the ability of regulatory agencies to do their job. And say that they've exceeded their authority. This is the whole Chevron doctrine. That'll come up later in the program. But right now, let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk about the other aspect of this, that it appears there's going to be a replacement for John McCain in the Senate. And I am quite sure this guy is going to vote to confirm Kavanaugh. We'll tell you why I am not a clairvoyant, but I would bet everything I own on this, and I'll tell you why when we return. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with Digby. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Digby, the decision to appoint this gives us, before we get into who is going to replace John McCain and the implications it's going to have for the Kavanaugh nomination fight and for other things, for that matter. And I know this happened last week. I was off, but John McCain passed away. And our friend Charlie Pierce had tweeted something online and, talking about hot takes about the funeral and this and that. And I'll be honest with you, I was on vacation. I didn't watch it. But he did say something at the end that I took issue with, which was, if my house is on fire, I'm not going to ask who's carrying the hose. And I totally agree with that calculation. But my problem is that John McCain was not carrying a hose. If the house on fire was a function of Donald Trump, John McCain was dressed in a fireman's outfit and basically showed up at the fire and said, I don't want this fire to rage, but I left my hose back on the truck. Or, you know, I got the hose. It's just I didn't want to hook it up to the fire hydrant. And John McCain could have resigned his seat, put it up for a vote in November of 2018. Instead, he did not. He hung on to the seat until he passed away, opening the door for Doug Ducey of Arizona to appoint John Kyle, former senator, the guy who ushered Kavanaugh literally from office to office in the Senate leading up to this nomination hearing. So he's pretty much a vote. But this is an example of John McCain sort of walking the walk, or I should say talking the talk, but not so much walking the walk, right? I mean, this has nothing to do with the fact that, yes, he was a war hero, but there were a lot of men who were captured by the Vietnamese and didn't talk, and we don't celebrate their deaths, so that's not why we're celebrating or eulogizing John McCain. There are a lot of senators as well, and we don't eulogize them in the same way. My beef with John McCain was he got a lot of credit for stuff that he talked about doing but didn't do. And I would note, for all of the talk about that one decision he made when he pulled that microphone away from that crazy woman who said that Barack Obama was a Muslim, He then handed that microphone to another crazy woman who, and frankly, in my opinion, far more a malignant a force in American politics and also a but for in terms of the rise of Donald Trump, and that's Sarah Palin. And you didn't hear very much talk about that decision he made.
Well, exactly. And I mean, I think we'll be debating this particular issue for some time about, you know, John McCain. It's not just him. It's Bob Corker. It's Jeff Flake. It's Ben Sasse. It's these Republicans who, you know, they take to Twitter in outrage and then end up voting down the line. And in McCain's case, or any of those guys, you know, to take your metaphor a little bit further, you know, they're standing around in their firemen's uniforms and they're going, oh my God, this is a terrible fire. It's awful. And in order to put the fire out, all they have to do is pick up the damned hose.
Right.
You know, I mean, all they have to do is do that, and they won't do it. Instead, they're just standing there kind of, it's kind of like they're sort of chicken littles, you know, sort of running around with their aprons over their heads, screaming, oh my God, this is terrible, and not doing anything. And yet, they have the power to do something. All it would take is two of them to say, you know what, we've had enough. We're going, you know, two of them who are retiring, by the way, or in McCain's case, actually knowing that he had a terminal illness. I mean, these people could have said, no, we're going to reorganize the Senate right now, and we're going to make Chuck Schumer the Senate majority leader, and we're not going to go along with this anymore. I mean, that is what they would have to do. Now, granted, that would be huge, and everybody'd be mad, and God only, I can't even imagine how many death threats they'd get from the Trump people. But they have the power to fix this. They could do it. And you know, the same thing is going to happen if impeachment comes along and we hear all these people, you know, if that does come to pass and there's some kind of hearings, we'll hear a lot and we'll have to see whether or not Republicans, can, right. You know, will put their money where their mouth is. And I haven't seen any evidence of it. Really, very little. I mean, Obamacare was the one thing that they've done.
Well, and we should say it was John McCain took that vote. But here's the thing is that I think, you know, when you talk about people who are going to retire, you talk about people who are going to pass away. There's only one conclusion, and that is they don't really mind what Trump is doing. That is, at the end of the day, is that they are relatively happy with what he is doing. They know that their talk will not make it stop. They know that they're not doing anything to make it stop. It's just a question of branding. And so that, to me, is what I think what made me feel so happy to be on vacation and not have to watch that funeral and sort of play along with this charade that branding is worth doing is equals doing something. And, you know, and this is... This is a maxim I think that we should be, you know, applying to all of our politicians, regardless of party. It's one thing to pose. It's another thing to actually do. And, you know, I say this following the week when Chuck Schumer, you know, made a deal to fast track about 15 federal judges. And
for what?
And
did he get out of that?
That was what I call, and we got to take a break here, and we can pick this up in the next hour. But I call that a quid pro nihil, which is something for nothing. And he gave something for nothing. But we'll talk more about that in the next hour. If you'll join me, Heather, I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Coming up, Matt Brunig from the People's Policy Project stops by to explain what a social wealth fund for America might entail. I'm Sam Seder. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. In a move that could combat wealth inequality in our country, our next guest has proposed that the U.S. government deal with the problem by creating a social wealth fund. Here to explain how that would work, Matt Brunig, founder of the People's Policy Project. All right, so Matt, You at the you folks at the People's Policy Project have come out with a pretty substantial policy paper on something called a social wealth fund that you are proposing America adopts. Let's first talk about the problem that a social wealth fund is you're proposing to solve. What is the problem that a social wealth fund will address?
The main problem is wealth inequality. So in the United States, millionaires own about 80% of the country's wealth, while the bottom third collectively owns nothing. And it's been getting, that level of inequality has been getting worse and worse year after year. So for example, in the last 10 years or so, the top 1% has increased their wealth on average by $4.9 million, while the median family has seen their wealth decline by $42,000. And so what we're trying to do is find some way to smooth out the distribution of wealth across the country in a gradual way that is economically responsible, and that's what the Social Wealth Fund is hoping to do.
And we should be clear here, when we're talking about wealth disparity, this is different from income disparity. This is the wealth that one has at any given time that is distinct from anything that might be coming in on an annual basis. And you know, one of the things I think people don't understand, too, is that the biggest, one of the biggest drivers of wealth in this country is has been home ownership over the years. And that, of course, takes a certain amount of money to establish in the first place. So this is a function, largely speaking, of we have all sorts of different policies in this country that makes it easier for money, essentially, to accumulate more money.
Yeah, and I would say it's not even just specific policies. I mean, we certainly have those. For instance, income received from stocks and bonds and rents are taxed generally at a lower rate than income received from working. And so if you have wealth, which generates interest and dividends, then you are able to kind of allow that wealth to accumulate because it doesn't get taxed as much. But also more generally, it's just the case that the nature of capitalism, if we can put it that way, is that people start out with small differences in income and wealth, and those differences compound over time. Because like you said, we're not talking about income, which is how much you get paid every year. We're talking about the accumulation of generations of income over time. And so that typically tends to concentrate wealth in the hands of a small number of people.
You wrote in the report that the percent of wealth owned by the top 10% of each demographic group. I mean, just before we move on to the solution here, just, you know, tease that out for us. What does that mean?
Yeah, so what I was trying to do there is some people, when they see that wealth is distributed very unevenly, their natural thought, their first thought is, well, let's think about this. You know, white families on average have a lot more wealth than black families and Latino families. Families where the head has a college degree has a lot more wealth than families whose head has less than a high school degree. And so there's a tendency to start to think, well, maybe the reason wealth inequality is so high is just because we have a lot of differences between some groups have a lot and other groups don't. And so what I try to show is, while it is absolutely true that some groups have way more wealth than others, it is also true that if you go into any given group, if you just look at black families, the top 10% of black families own 70% of black wealth. If you just look at people who only have a high school degree, the top 10% of families who only have a high school degree own 70, 75% of that group's wealth. And so it's not a issue of some groups have more than others. It pops up over and over again in every demographic group.
So in some respects, it's both things are operating. We have some racial disparities. We have some demographic disparities. But there is some fundamental dynamic that exists within the context of capitalism that promotes this type of disparity. And so this social wealth fund is almost letting a little bit of air out of the tire, as it were. So, all right. So go into, give us the broad definition before we go into some of the details and the historical examples of a social wealth fund. What does that mean, a social wealth fund?
Yeah, so on the most general level, a social wealth fund is a collectively held financial fund that is fully owned by the public and used for the benefit of society as a whole. When you get into particulars, what we're basically talking about is, you know how universities have endowments where they have these big piles of money and they invest them, and those investments create return that they then spend on the university? We'll take that idea, but put it for the whole country, and we'll have an endowment for the whole country that we all benefit from. That endowment, when it gets investment returns, those investment returns can either be paid out to everyone in society as a universal dividend. It could be used for social welfare purposes. It could be used for a variety of things, but that's the basic idea. So let's get one of these big funds going, like they have at universities, or like mutual funds have, or like hedge funds have. Let's get one of those going, but for everyone in the country instead of for a small group of institutions and affluent investors.
So the idea is just that the United States as a country will invest in the way that other large institutions do. It's just that it's for the benefit of all citizens. How is this? I mean, how analogous is this to the Social Security Trust Fund? We pay taxes into Social Security. That money sits in a fund that is ostensibly collecting interest and is there to try and smooth out demographic bumps, right? We had the baby boom, and then things dropped off a little bit, and the millennials are big. And so this is that trust fund is supposed to smooth that out. How similar or different is it from that idea?
In broad strokes, it's similar. The Social Security Trust Fund is a unique thing because all of the money in it is invested in treasury bonds. So it's the government is buying its own debt as an investment. So there are some weird components to it. But if you could imagine a situation where you had Social Security funds, and instead of them being invested in treasury debt, they were invested in real estate, invested in stocks or bonds or other kinds of things like that. That would be very similar. And there are countries that do that. For instance, in Finland, their social security funds for old age and disability pension are invested in these kinds of assets.
All right. Well, look, we're going to take a break here. And when we come back, I want you to go through the history of these funds, how it would be implemented in this country. And, you know, who would be the beneficiaries of this fund? I mean, presumably the American citizens. I'm also curious as to how much Wall Street skims off this. That's, you know, that makes me a little bit nervous. Let's talk about that when we return. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio, talking to Matt Brunig about his proposal, or I should say the People's Policies Project proposal, for a social wealth fund for America. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking to Matt Brunig about his idea to create a social wealth fund for America. So, Matt, when we broke, you had basically walked us through what a social wealth fund is. It is a, it would be a fund set up by the United States of America that many other institutions have similarly, like you described it, akin to a college endowment fund, where presumably money from taxes would go into a big fund that has invested in things like real estate, perhaps in bonds and also in equities and stocks. And so who would oversee this? Like, who would, I mean, I guess that one of the things that crops up in my mind before we even get to the benefits of this is this sort of notion of, this seems like in many respects, like, you know, Wall Street's wet dream, all this so-called dumb money that they get to manage and or at least benefit from sort of inflating the stock market. Why is that not a concern?
Yeah, so when it comes to money management, the proposal is to create a new government corporation that will be a fund manager. This is how they do it in Alaska. They have something called the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, and it's a state-owned company that is basically an asset manager, and they manage the money. So they're not paying off fees to Wall Street banks to handle the funds like a lot of endowments or pension funds do. They just manage it in-house with their own government employees. Norway does the same thing, and that's what I propose to do here. So in a way, it's actually a threat to Wall Street firms, because if we're shifting money away from affluent people to put into this fund, then we are reducing the amount of assets Wall Street is managing and increasing the amount of assets this new fund is managing. The second,
and we should
point
just say the.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. We just want to say, just to, for people who don't know, Alaska's permanent fund is basically kickbacks from the oil that is taken out of Alaska, right?
I mean, it's they took the oil revenue and then they put it in a fund, and then that fund is invested in equities and bonds and real estate, and then the return on that is parceled out as a dividend. So the money got in the fund through oil, but they're not receiving like a direct check from oil.
All right, and so continue on. You were going to address, I think, the part about inflating the stock market.
Right, yeah. So the way I've got it set up in the plan is, one, to fund the program, we're going to use quite a lot of taxes on assets. We're going to tax financial transactions. We're going to tax the market capitalization of companies. We're going to tax hedge funds for the amount of assets that they're managing. And those kinds of taxes, their first order effect would be to depress stock market prices. And then you get the revenue in, and you use that revenue to go buy those assets, which will then pump the prices back up. So in theory, there's no real net effect on the price of securities being traded on stock markets. And secondarily, there are ways that you can run the program that takes advantage of when the stock market takes a dive. So when the stock market collapsed in 2008, if the federal government had been ready, it could have bought up a ton of stock at a really cheap price because it was way down and benefited from that gain. So you can take advantage of those kinds of things. So instead of driving the price up way beyond where it is, you get it when it's really cheap.
And so, okay, so that's the way that this works. And how do we determine the benefits of this? I mean, do we just get a check every quarter? Is it subject to taxes? What happens?
In the plan as written, what we're going to do is you're going to take 4% of the value of the fund every year. You'll average that out over 5 years. And then you'll pay that out as an annual dividend. So in hard numbers terms, basically every $1 trillion that's in the fund will kick out $160 of dividends per adult. So if you got up to $10 trillion, that's $1,600. If you got up to $50 trillion, that's $8,000. And for reference, the U.S. as a whole has $100 trillion of wealth floating around. So $50 trillion is only half of that, which would still put you below the amount of wealth that the state of Norway has in its funds.
And so this would be delivered to every American citizen and as just basically a rebate.
Yeah, just like, the Social Security Administration pays out checks. It's a similar kind of thing.
And so, okay, so where has this been effective and where has it failed, and what was the difference between those two setups?
So in Alaska, it's been very effective. It's been around, the Alaska Permanent Fund has been around since 1976, and they've been paying dividends since 1982. The fund value just keeps going up and up. The highest dividend I think they had was a little over $2,000, which would be about $8,000 for a family of four, which is not insignificant for a lot of families in this country. In terms of places where it has failed, I remember there was a small island nation, whose name I now forget when I was doing my research, whose version of this failed really badly. And what they had done is invest the money in an ice skating production for some reason, and that didn't work out. So, you know, the main way it's going to fail is if you just don't manage the assets very well.
They invested in like an ice capades thing?
Yeah, believe it or not, yes.
Yeah, that, I mean, I'm no, I am not going to claim any expertise when it comes to managing money, but that seems like a classic case of putting all your eggs into one very, very unstable basket. So, I mean, why wouldn't we do this? I mean, where is the political pushback on this? Where is the policy pushback that you see on this now that you've introduced it?
So the main political pushback is going to be, you know, that this is socialistic. You know, what we're asking the government to do is to go out and buy up America's capital stock. And, you know, it is socialistic in that sense, but it's also a socialistic policy that has been very successful and that works, right? We're not talking, Alaska doesn't have food shortages because of their fund, neither does Norway. So you have some people who are just uncomfortable with the state amassing, you know, big piles of the nation's wealth. Other than that, you know, on the left, you have people who, I would say the main critique is just about prioritization. You know, we have so much stuff we need to do. We haven't even insured everyone in the country yet to have health care. Like, this is something that kind of should happen down the line. That I think is a primary thing I've seen from the left. And I don't fully disagree with that. I wouldn't say this is priority number one, but it's, you know, it's something we should keep in the quiver in case we get to the point where we could do something like it.
So in other words, this is something that would ride on top of the social safety net as it stands now, and hopefully a more enhanced and more generous and comprehensive one that we could see in the future. Well, it's a fascinating idea, and it seems to me that from a political standpoint, you already had the Republicans, you know, for years, I mean, as recently as 2005, I think, advocating the idea of putting the Social Security Trust Fund into the stock market. So the idea that the government would at the very least send tax dollars into the stock market or in equities and whatnot is certainly not one that is particularly radical. I guess it's just the idea of, do you want to have to pay the extra fee for the private industry to manage this fund versus the government? And, you know, this isn't rocket science. You know, short of investing in ice capades, I think we would be okay. Matt Brunig, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Matt Brunig is the founder of the People's Policy Project. You can read all the details of his social wealth fund idea over at thepeoplespolicyproject.org. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from this past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget ROFpodcast.com to support the show and hear what you've been missing. Happy holidays. This is Sam Cedar from Ring of Fire Radio. It's a best of, and we will be back in 2019. We are back. This is the second hour of the show, and if you're just joining us, you can go to ROFpodcast.com. Listen to the whole episode commercial-free by becoming a member. Back to help me run down the biggest news stories of the week, Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, in the last hour, we were talking about the politics around the Kavanaugh hearing, and also the politics around John McCain's passing, the funeral, the subsequent appointment of John Kyle by Doug Ducey, the governor of Arizona, to sit in John McCain's seat for at least, I guess, another 2 years, right? The special election will be in 2020. Because John McCain did not give up his seat in enough time before the November 2018 election for that special election to take place then. And so I want to touch on the piece that you wrote about Lindsey Graham, too. He sits on the judiciary. He was out there this weekend, or last weekend, I should say, creating a little space for Kavanaugh to respond to questions about Roe v. Wade by saying that it would almost be disqualifying for Kavanaugh not to entertain the idea of reversing precedent, regardless of what that precedent is. And we can talk about that a little bit, but let's talk just a little bit about what also took place last week, which was, I think it was around a week ago Tuesday. Chuck Schumer made a deal, and I don't even know how you can call it a deal, because usually a deal involves both parties receiving something. But Chuck Schumer made a deal to essentially fast-track 15 federal judges, lifetime appointments, one of whom was deemed by the ABA as completely unqualified to sit as a judge, right? I mean, like, this is the same rating that you would give to someone who, I don't know, was, you know, just, I don't know, I'm a podcast host. Right, you, someone who's not a lawyer. Never mind, someone to be appointed to a lifetime position. So Chuck Schumer does this, and to be fair, any senator, any sitting senator on the Democratic or independent side could have stood up and said, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to hold up the Senate. But they fast-tracked this ostensibly to give Democrats more time to campaign at home. But this is absurd. I mean, why would we elect Democrats if not to stop this type of stuff?
Well, and what would happen if they said, you know, if he didn't make that deal? What? So... What's his name? I'm going
Joe
blank
Manchin,
on the Senate majority,
right.
Geordie leader's name.
McConnell.
You know, McConnell, right. Sorry about that. That, you know, he holds the Senate open in order to pass these judges. They pass them on some kind of party line vote. I guess maybe they can't get a quorum. Is that the idea if the Democrats just said, hey, we're out of here?
No.
We're going to go campaign. We're not doing it. I mean,
but
what
then
would
it would
happen?
Also hold the Republicans in office too, right? I mean, it's like, you know,
well, exactly.
And in this era, I mean, I just don't see how it, you know, genuinely creates a negative impact on these things. But the whole reason to vote for Democrats is so that they mount some type of defense against Donald Trump. And how do you justify laying down on that defense? And look, this is a situation where obviously Chuck Schumer, you know, whipped this, right? I mean, because there could be senators out there who say, like, well, I'm not going to do this, but they're intimidated, because their leadership is against it. I mean, I don't understand even how this is reported as a deal. What did he get in return?
I don't either. Well, that's the part that I don't get. Everything I've read about this, there's been no real sense that, you know, it doesn't make any sense. In other words, I cannot figure out why he did it. I don't know what the deal was or what he thought he was getting. The idea of them having to go home to campaign, that just doesn't hold water. That doesn't make sense. There had to be some other reason that he did it, but nobody knows what it is. And the truth is, I mean, come on, how many judges does Trump get to have?
Right.
I mean, compared to what Obama got through, which they were, you know, they trickled through at an absolute ridiculous pace. He was hardly able to make an impact on the court through 8 years, and they've been confirming him, you know, 10 at a time.
One out of seven judges on the circuit court system is now a Trump appointee. One out of seven after 2 years. That is a stunning, stunning number. And
it's insane.
And this is, you know, this is the whole kit and caboodle, right? I mean, this is the whole game for the Republicans. And Maybe it's unfair. I don't think it is. Certainly, critiquing Chuck Schumer, I am not the only person to do that. There are people who are very familiar with Senate rules who are arguing that there is a lot more that Chuck Schumer could do if he had any ability to lead. And, you know, this is there's been a lot of attention paid to Nancy Pelosi's leadership. But the fact of the matter is that from the left, anyways, from the left, I don't see any heir apparent right now who has stepped up, who could take the leadership position from Nancy Pelosi from the left. There's a couple from the right, and I'm not too happy with those.
No.
There are plenty of people from the left, it seems to me, who could step up and take this job from Chuck Schumer and do it and do it better. And it's just interesting in the context of the Senate how you do not hear that as much. And I wonder if we're going to start hearing that more. I mean, I don't know. I don't recall a time in my lifetime where a Senate leader has been voted out by its caucus. I don't remember one. I mean, it's happened in the context of the House, but you don't see it as much in the Senate. And I would like to see it now, frankly.
Well, yeah, me too. I mean, I think that, look, you know, I understand that opposing a sort of, this force of Trumpism and this completely corrupt Republican Party that are his accomplices, it's not easy. This is a tough thing to deal with. I get it. But that's their job. That's what they're paid for. I mean, what has happened over the course of these 2 years is that the Republicans have been able to enact their, you know, most important goals under Trump, someone for whom they have obviously, or most of them have no respect whatsoever, but doesn't matter. They do the Grover Norquist thing, put a pen in his hand and he'll sign it. But judges and taxes. I mean, those were the bottom line holy grail, you know, achievements of the first 2 years of the Trump administration. Even if he is forced to resign or he is impeached or he, you know, whatever happens going forward, they will have achieved their most important goals is to do that. And all they have left is to try and do more. I keep hearing they're going to pass some more tax cuts for crying out loud in the lame duck session because basically they can't think of anything else to do. They've done everything that they wanted. So, you know, you look at this kind of thing, this is very, very difficult. It's hard to deal with a corrupt regime, and they really are a regime, of people who have just basically said, we're going to win by any means necessary. We know all the rules, norms, everything is out the window. We're going to do whatever we have to do to get this done. Having said that, there are things that that the Democrats have not done to, you know, they haven't looked at this and gone, look, we're in an existential crisis. And we are. The judiciary has now been completely taken over by far right extremists, many of whom are unqualified and unfit for those jobs. Now, I don't think people realize just how that this is the kind of stuff that kind of it cascades down into people's regular real lives. And people are going to be feeling this.
It has been, and we got to take a break here, but the biggest failure on the left, it seems to me, center to the left, is that they do not appreciate the relevance of the courts. It has been a failure that, and it is why the right and the Federalist Society have been able to take them over, because they just have not been, they are just not part of the understanding of how our government works by the center and the left. All right, we've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We got a lot more to talk about, Digny. There's got to be somebody out there. We are back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Parton, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, we were talking about the sort of the failures of the leadership in the Senate, Democratic leadership, to really mount a significant challenge to the one of the main things that the Republicans have been able to and have sought to achieve, and that, of course, is dominance over the federal court system. With that said, there is increasing reason to believe that we're going to see a blue wave, at least in the context of the House. Who knows in terms of the Senate? There are polls that are starting to come out now. Washington Post had one, ABC News, others that have come out this past week that are, you're starting to see a, at least from the pollster's perspective, a clearer picture of who's going to come out to vote. And when you start to get a better sense of who the likely voter is going to be, you start to see that Democrats have a significant advantage. More than 6 in 10 Americans say Trump and the Republican Party are out of touch. Democrats, only 5 out of 10, but that's a pretty big difference, right? I mean, that's 10 percentage polls. Registered voters say they'd favor the Democratic candidate over the Republican candidate in their district by 52% to 38%. That is pretty stunning, because we're talking about registered voters, and I don't think you could find anyone who would argue to you that Democrats aren't more motivated than Republicans. So if registered voters are already favoring Democrats by 14%, likely voters have to be larger than that, right? I mean, so that those, when you start getting to those double digits, those are the numbers that could really create an avalanche.
Well, yeah, or to use the common term, that a tsunami, right? I mean, we've got the blue wave, and maybe this is going to be a huge blue wave. I don't want to make predictions. I'm gun shy on that, but that the numbers do certainly appear that that the Democrats have a good chance of taking the House. And it's interesting to look at that poll, because in the poll it really indicates what's driving people, and it's Trump. I mean, and there's nothing unusual about that. That isn't something that's just, oh, Trump is so uniquely terrible that he's bringing people out. The first midterm after an election, it's often a referendum on the president. I mean, that's just, it's, you got 2 years, you evaluate what happened, in the previous 2 years, and they go in and vote with the president. I mean, there are exceptions to that. In 2002, George W. Bush actually gained seats for the Republicans gained seats, but that was right after 9/11, right? So there was this rally around the flag thing. But it's very often that this happens. What makes this unique is what appears to be the real, size and scope of the enthusiasm on the part of Democrats to put some kind of a break on the Trump White House. And basically, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, the Democrats have a big agenda. They've been putting out all kinds of plans and platforms that they want to enact. I mean, obviously, that won't happen as long as Donald Trump is in the White House. He won't sign legislation passed by progressive Democrats. I'd be shocked if he did. But that's not the point. The point is that they're out there with a full platform, and they are providing this place for people to put this decision that they've made about Donald Trump and the Republicans. And the Republicans who, by the way, have enabled him all the way along and are serving as his accomplices in the Congress. So, the size of this is that poll was what really kind of astonished me, because what I had read before was that what you would find, you'd find months and months and months maybe of seeing a big wave coming, and then as it got closer, it would actually start to retreat a little bit. Maybe that's the way a tsunami does, right? It kind of comes, and then it retreats out, and then it whoosh, the big things come. But that doesn't seem to be happening. This wave is still building, and as you point out, with registered voters having that kind, I mean, that's 14 points. That's way beyond the margin required to take the House, if that holds up, across the board in districts. And if the wave is big enough, there's a remote chance that the Senate could go too. I mean, that does happen. People topple you didn't expect to in a major wave. So, I think that Democrats have to be very, very, very cautious, keep their nose to the grindstone, don't even look up, just keep working, working, working. But it is looking a little bit more positive. And, another poll that came out in the first poll after the primary in Florida with the Democrat Andrew Gillum up by 3 points, which kind of surprised me. But it so he's at least got a running start.
Yep. It's going to be fascinating to see how this shakes out. Look, we just had about 90 seconds left. Just quickly, Donald Trump tweeted out an inaccurate tweet. I mean, that's not a surprise, about Jeff Sessions and about the two investigations happening into Republican congresspeople. One is Duncan Hunter. One is Chris Collins. Trump claimed that these investigations started during the Obama years. Of course, Chris Collins, it did not. The crime in which he was arrested for took place during the Trump administration. But nevertheless, do you get the sense between that and the Devin Nunes audio, and we'll talk about this more, I'm sure, going forward, but let's put a flagpole in the ground right now. We got 40 seconds left here. Tell me, do you think that we're looking at some type of like Saturday Night Massacre taking place sometime after the elections, come hell or high water?
Yes. I think there's no doubt. Lindsey Graham signaled, Chuck Grassley did, go ahead and fire Sessions. That's the signal to go. And I think that unless something really drastic happens in the election or something else, maybe Mueller comes down with a report, or some kind of indictments, I think it's going to happen. I don't think there's any doubt at this point. I will be very, very shocked if Trump doesn't go ahead and fire Sessions after the midterms. I think the deal, who was it? Bob Corker said the fix is in. I think that's
right.
It.
Yeah, it certainly feels that way, but we will have a better sense as time goes on. As always, Digby, thanks for joining us this week. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Sam, as always.
Just ahead, we'll find out why 4 West Virginia Supreme Court justices are being impeached. With West Virginia native and progressive radio host Bob Kincaid, I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio.
I had a dream about a burning house. You were stuck inside, I couldn't get you out. I laid beside you and pulled you close.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. The impeachment proceedings of 4 of 5 West Virginia Supreme Court justices could be a move to check a corrupt court or attack on a state judiciary system's independence, depending on your perspective. The outcome is sure to have national implications. Here to discuss, progressive radio host Bob Kincaid. So, Bob, I want to start with, and we'll get to Joe Manchin and what your take is about his take on Brett Kavanaugh, because Joe Manchin, it strikes me, is one of the key votes that the Democrats need to lock up if there's any chance of even a remote one of stopping Brett Kavanaugh. But before we get there, let's talk about the West Virginia Supreme Court. This is the strangest thing. I saw this. I said, I gotta talk to Bob Kincaid about this because I don't know what to make of this. This is the kind of thing that you read about in, you know, banana republics where almost the entire a significant amount of how big is the West Virginia Supreme Court that they could impeach in 1 week 4 of the judges?
There's 5 members to the court, Sam. And they all serve staggered 12-year terms. And in the 230-some-odd year history of this country, this has never happened before, where a legislature just moved in and decided to throw out the entire Supreme Court. When you look at the whole backstory, though, it begins to look pretty obviously like it's a Trumpian coup.
All right. Well, it's okay. Before we get to the backstory, tell us the front story. 4 Supreme Court justices were impeached in the West Virginia House of Delegates, I guess a week or so ago, right? And what ostensibly were they impeached for?
One of the 5 justices had decided to take into his possession and take home with him what was described as a historically significant desk. And it turned out he was playing fast and loose with the company credit card, as it were. And then it became obvious that the court had engaged in some lavish living, insofar as they'd spent one justice had spent $30,000 on a couch. And wow. They'd spent horse-gagging amounts of money on redecorating the wing of the state capitol that houses the offices and the chambers of the Supreme Court. And so that led, you know, nobody, Democrat or Republican, looked at that and said, oh, you know, that's okay. But then the Republicans got the bit in their teeth, and the guy, Alan Lawfrey, who had done the really bad stuff, well, it turns out he got himself in hot water with the feds. But the Republican-controlled legislature, which took control of the legislature in 2014 for the first time in 83 years, said, hey, let's get rid of all of them because the majority of them are Democrats. And so, you know, if you do that, you've consolidated power. You know, Jim Justice ran as a Democrat to become governor. He had never really been a Democrat, but he got talked into it. So he gets elected. There's a Republican majority. He flips over. Donald Trump comes down here and pats him on his little head for becoming a Republican that he was all along. And then the only thing standing in the way of complete consolidation of power is the Supreme Court of Appeals of the state of West Virginia. So they mounted this impeachment and accused all of the justices of maladministration of justice and profligate spending, and then voted along party lines to impeach the lot of them, two of them having been impeached and resigned, and two of them are going to stand and be tried by the Senate later this month.
Wow. And so this is obviously an attempt to simply replace these justices. Will they be replaced with members of the party that they came from, or is this ostensibly?
No. Two of them have already been replaced, and this is just beautiful. One of them is my congressman, Evan Jenkins, a Republican, ran against Patrick Morrissey and Don Blankenship to get the chance to run against Joe Manchin. Evan Jenkins lost. So Evan Jenkins was out of a job as soon as the November elections are over with. So it just so happened that Jim Justice said, hey, Evan's not doing anything. Let's appoint him to one of the empty seats, and then appointed a leader from the legislature to the other empty seat. And here's the fun part, Sam. Neither one of these people know which part of the courtroom to walk into.
Right.
They're not litigators. They haven't tried so much as a case in magistrate court.
Are there no judges, no lawyers in that state? Or is it just that Justice was looking for some reliable votes down the road?
Justice was looking for reliable votes down the road, Sam, because Jim Justice has big problems because Jim Justice has cases coming up before the Supreme Court because, among other things, you know how we've never seen Donald Trump's tax returns? Well, we know about Jim Justice's taxes, and what we know about Jim Justice is that he doesn't pay them.
Hmm. Wow. This is crazy. I mean, how are locals responding to this? I mean, it seems to me so bold to impeach 4/5 of your Supreme Court in a week and replace them all with essentially cronies. How does this keep happening? Stuff like this in West Virginia.
Well, when you plant a seed in corrupted ground, the thing that grows out of it is going to be corrupted too. And West Virginia's political system has been corrupted by the control of hydrocarbon and extraction industries for almost as long as there's been a West Virginia. And so in many ways, people, to the extent they pay attention to it at all, tend to look up and say, well, it's just business as usual. Now, I'm not talking about progressive people or liberal people or the kind of folks that listen to your program and mine. I'm talking about people who are just, you know, going day to day and not paying attention to a whole lot of anything. But if it turns out there's something filthy going on in Charleston, they tend to look up and go, well, yeah, of course, because it's Charleston.
So there's a certain amount of, like, learned cynicism that we're dealing with down there.
Yeah, if we could use as big a word as cynicism, there's also a whole lot of don't give a damnism. As long because what sells in the political process in West Virginia, Sam, is the precious little fetuses and our precious guns and how much we all love God. And once you get past that, not so much. I mean, we've got a community here in my little county right now that has not had drinkable water for 2 weeks, more than 2 weeks. Is that on the headlines? Not so much.
Well, why hasn't it had drinkable water for 2 weeks?
It's a little public service district that sits below a mountaintop removal operation, and they were amazed to find out that the water is not fit to drink, and they're blaming it on bad pipes or old pipes or there's some iron in the water or something. But the fact of the matter is, it's just more neglected infrastructure inside a state that, for all its natural beauty, it could probably very easily be declared the world's largest Superfund site.
All right. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to ask you, what are the rulings that the West Virginia Supreme Court, what kind of stuff do they deal with? Why is it so crucial? And you mentioned that part of the reason could be the fact that Jim Justice has not paid any income taxes for a while and may anticipate some type of action being brought to the Supreme Court? I don't know. You'll tell me. But beyond that, what are the implications of this completely, jerry-rigged, I don't know how else to call it, Supreme Court in West Virginia? And then, since we're talking about Supreme Courts, obviously, your Senator Joe Manchin is a pivotal figure in the fight to stop Brett Kavanaugh. Want to get your take on what his take is on these nomination hearings. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. I'm talking to the great Bob Kincaid. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking to Bob Kincaid, host of The Horn, about the national implications involving the impeachment of four West Virginia justices. So, Bob, when we broke, we were talking about, and you were telling us, this really sort of incredible story of four out of the five West Virginian Supreme Court justices have now been impeached on 11 of 14 articles of impeachment. The four justices who have been, I guess, suspended, Alan Loffrey, Margaret Workman, Robin Davis, and Elizabeth Walker, are set to go on trial in the West Virginia Senate. Is that right? Or are they? Where are we in that process?
It's mostly right. Loffrey's gone. Minnis Ketchum retired. Robin Davis retired. That meant that their replacements will be more temporary. On the other hand, Margaret Workman and Beth Walker, they're going to stand trial. Those two are going to stand trial before the Senate on their charges of impeachment. So Workman, for instance, was on the bench recently when Don Blankenship brought his case in complaint that it violated his constitutional rights and those of the Constitution Party for him not to be on the Senate ballot against Joe Manchin and Patrick Morrissey. They're still on the court, but if the West Virginia Senate votes by a two-thirds majority and there are 34 members of the West Virginia Senate, then they're removed from office according to the Constitution of the state.
So what are the implications of that? I mean, what kind of cases do reach the Supreme Court of West Virginia?
Everything. The Supreme Court of Appeals of West Virginia, unlike most states, we don't have an intermediate court of appeals. So if you are convicted of a felony in circuit court, you file a petition for appeal to the West Virginia Supreme Court. Capital cases, it's there's an automatic review. Let's say you lose a civil trial and you've got a judgment entered against you for $1 million or whatever, the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals hears those appeals too. It is literally, you know, it's literally the final say in the entire judicial business of the state of West Virginia. And here's the thing: we used to have partisan election of justices. So you had to say, "Hi, my name is, and I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican," and you ran like any other politician. Then they got the wise idea that they would make it nonpartisan election because Republicans don't like to admit being Republicans on the ballot. And so now we have nonpartisan election. So Margaret Workman was elected as a Democrat, and she's standing under impeachment. But Beth Walker was also impeached, and she was elected on a nonpartisan basis. Back in 2016 of Hillary Clinton saying, "We're going to put coal miners out of work." Those were her ads.
Interesting. All right. So, Bob, all right. So I guess we'll get a better sense of how this works out. Do you have a timeline for us?
I think they're due to stand trial on the 14th, maybe. It's about the middle of the month.
All right. Well, fair enough. So let's turn for a moment, since we got a couple more minutes here, to the Supreme Court of the United States and Brett Kavanaugh. It is, I think, rather uncontroversial and probably widely understood that Joe Manchin is one of several Democratic senators who could very well vote to confirm a Brett Kavanaugh. And this, of course, would ensure his ascendance to the Supreme Court. There's no assurance that if they were to reject him, that it would stop this trajectory. But certainly it can't happen without them. Joe Manchin, like I say, is one of the important linchpins, it seems to me, that in stopping Brett Kavanaugh, because if Joe Manchin can get up there and say at a state that has, what, a 63% approval rating for Donald Trump, if he can get up there and say, "I don't need to support Brett Kavanaugh, this is not going to influence my reelection campaign whatsoever," that's going to send a message to other Democratic senators. Give me your sense of, like, what you perceive are the politics as Joe Manchin sees them, as to why he wouldn't already announce, "I'm against Brett Kavanaugh," when we all know that Brett Kavanaugh has something like a, I don't know, 5% approval rating, which is one of the lowest we've seen for a Supreme Court nominee in ages. So what's the dynamic there?
Well, Joe is taking the Democratic base of this state, which still enjoys a significant lead over registered Republicans, he's taking them for granted. And the political calculus, as far as I can tell, is that Joe has said, "Well, I've got the Democrats and they'll let me do anything because I'm running against somebody who's really, truly horrible in Patrick Morrissey. I've got to bring along those independent Trump voters in order to beat Morrissey." And he's got 8-9 points, depending on the polling you look at, on Morrissey right now. So it's outside the margin of error, but it's still too close for comfort. So he's more concerned with keeping the Trumpers happy than he is with keeping his own base happy. And so I don't want him to, but I would expect him to break with the Democrats. If he doesn't, I will be pleasantly surprised.
But is voting for Brett Kavanaugh that much of a big deal for his voters, or is it just a question of, like, you don't do something that Trump disagrees with, or is it a genuine fear that Trump will come to West Virginia and start campaigning against him?
He's scared to death of Donald Trump's bully pulpit ability in this state. After all, Trump already came here and campaigned against him just a couple of weeks ago. And if he votes, and it's not just that, it's the ads and all the dark money. We're not used to seeing the kind of money spent on elections in our state that we're seeing spent. For instance, I can't open up an 80s music video on YouTube without seeing an ad first that tells me that Joe Manchin is a godless liberal.
Wow.
which is so laughable as to be ridiculous. But it's also real. So he right. has to take that into account. But there are arguments to be made that I think he could make cogently for why he wouldn't vote for him. And frankly, I've been encouraging my friends around here to get in touch with his office and just simply say, look, how is it that you can vote to put a guy on the Supreme Court who was nominated by somebody who's implicated in four federal felonies? How do you do that?
Right. You would imagine that. And so lastly, we got about 20 seconds left. Is that the argument to make, like a procedural one, like there's something tainted with Donald Trump, or maybe that Kavanaugh has lied in prior judicial hearings? I mean, that to me seems like the special sauce, right? Something that's more procedural and less ideological. Is that right?
Absolutely. That's the only argument, because frankly, 62, 68, maybe 70% of this state would be thrilled to death if he voted to put a justice on the Supreme Court who will protect the precious little fetuses.
Right. Bob Kincaid, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Sam.
Bob Kincaid is a West Virginia native, host of the radio program The Horn. You can find out more at headon.live. When we come back, Facebook and Twitter, we're in front of Congress this week. We'll talk to Angelo Carrizone from Media Matters. And if you missed any part of this show, go to rofpodcast.com, become a member, get the full show without commercials. Or you can listen to any of our archive shows with all your favorite guests. I'm Sam Cedar. We'll be right back after the break. Happy holidays. This is Sam Cedar from Ring of Fire Radio. It's a best of, and we will be back in 2019. Welcome back to the third hour of Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Don't forget, you can support the show by going to rofpodcast.com, signing up for the free one-hour podcast, or by becoming a member and getting the full show at an amazing deal. Tech companies such as Facebook and Twitter testified at a congressional hearings this week, and here to give us the rundown of the questions the social media giants faced, Angelo Carrizone, president of Media Matters. So, Angelo, obviously a hugely busy week in the news this week, particularly in terms of hearings. A lot of people focusing on the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. I have to concede that I am one of those people. But meanwhile, there was also some very important other hearings taking place on Capitol Hill this week. The CEOs of two of the biggest social media, I guess, applications, companies, Twitter and Facebook, showed up to testify in front of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. The CEO of Google, which is, Alphabet, which is the parent company of Google, did not show up, Larry Page. And then there was another hearing, which we will get to in a bit. But give us a sense as to why these folks were called up in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and what are the implications down the road?
So think about this as actually a culmination of pressure that the Senate Intelligence Committee and Congress more broadly has been putting on social media platforms to actually get these CEOs to the table in the first place. There have been a few other hearings, but they've mostly been with either mid-level staff or senior staff or lawyers. They didn't really have the top decision makers for the company. So it's been something they've been clamoring for and calling for, and they finally got it. And at least with respect to the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing, it was a pretty serious hearing, actually. And if you just look at the nature of the questions and the direction across the political aisle, regardless of politics, it is clear that the senators themselves have definitely learned a lot from when they first started delving into this territory at, you know, in 2017. And the real focus, though, was on the way that the social platforms have been dealing with foreign interference in particular, and how they've been grappling with known problems. And then, you know, they actually started getting into things like, you know, trends, which I was sort of shocked about, to be honest. I mean, that was the one piece I was like, I can't believe the senators were actually up to speed on some of that stuff. So that was it. They basically brought these decision makers in today to sort of do a report back on previous hearings that they've had with some other staff, and to get a sense of whether or not the social platforms have made some really meaningful steps in addressing the gaps that allowed for and enabled, in some situations, a lot of foreign interference in our political conversation.
Now, we should say, and this is the premise I think that you know, people have to understand, there is it seems to me it's uncontroversial at this point. The ability of, let's say, Facebook, I was going to say a Facebook, but let's be specific, Facebook, for actually changing the behavior of voters. They did their own internal experiments a couple years ago, which showed this. And and certainly there's plenty of data out there that they can change the behavior of voters. At the time that this experiment was run, people were sort of outraged that they ran this experiment, right?
And yeah, they were.
So the idea that any force could come in and do this, but this is where it's very sort of like, it's a very complicated question, right? Because advertisers are advertising and paying on there to change people's behaviors. Other campaigns are going on there to change people's behaviors. I guess the question is like, who is allowed and not? And it's a little bit clear when you're talking about a foreign power, because they're not supposed to involve themselves theoretically in any of our elections. But then it's also, you know, what rules govern it in terms of like when it's unfair, right? Like if it's found out that an American enterprise was able to isolate who to target with money from Russia or with operatives from Russia, I mean, it starts to get a little bit murky.
No, it really does, and you're right. There's a lot of gray area, and so what I try to do when I think about this problem is, because you know, I'm a liberal, but I'm also somebody, and which is to me not an illiberal thing, that believes in free speech, right, and that actually is really concerned around corporate power, and doesn't want big companies necessarily censoring or getting into the business of being the arbiters of fact on everything, you know. So I start to think about, well, what am I calling for really, and try to balance that. And so when I start this exercise, or sort of start going down that path, I take all the stuff in the gray area and I put it to the side for a minute. And then I look at, what are the black and white stuff? Because from my perspective, if we can't even deal with the things that are black and white, the really clear, cut and dry things that you would expect from these social platforms, then I definitely don't want them getting into the more murky things, because that means they're very likely to mess it up. And so one thing that is clear is that if you go back and look, and this relates both to the ability to change behavior but also manipulate the landscape more broadly, there was a lot of flat-out cheating going on, things that are totally manipulative. So, for example, the ability to use bots, especially on Facebook, to trick Facebook's algorithm into thinking that a story, maybe a total fabrication story, you know, that Hillary's on a breathing machine or Obama bans the Pledge of Allegiance or things like that. If you could use a bunch of bots, you know, a few thousand of them, to like that story very quickly, you could actually trick Facebook into distributing it for you. One of their big measurements is velocity. And so if a story has a really fast, if it's getting high levels of engagement really fast, Facebook will actually amplify that and start to serve it out to friends of friends of friends even. So they'll really help with the distribution. And so that is, you know, one of the things that was taking place in 2016 was that there was a lot of algorithmic manipulation, so flat-out cheating. The other thing that was taking place, though, is in the form of some of these advertisements. a lot of advertisements that would not have been approved otherwise through the standard approval process, because they had too much text, for example, were actually getting approved because the right wing had basically convinced Facebook that they were going to censor them, or that they were being censored if they didn't approve them fast enough. And a lot of those ads were actually suppressive. So, you know, they would target first-time voters with "don't wait in line, text to vote here" kind of stuff. And very much focused their advertising efforts in swing states, and in particular against marginalized communities, people of color in particular. And the idea was to trick as many as you can, peel off a few votes here and there in the places where it'll matter the most by basically duping people. And that's the kind of stuff that is cheating, that both is against the rules or should be against the rules. And Facebook was just kind of asleep at the wheel, and in some situations was a participant in it. So that stuff is pretty cut and dry. And it's really important to think about that first, because it gets into the bigger concerns, like what happens in the future? Because if they can't stop the cheating that we know about, then what about the cheating like synthetic video and synthetic audio? And how are these big companies thinking about preventing that from becoming the next fake news crisis? So that's one piece. You're right on the organizing front. The thing that scares me, and that sort of stop, is on the change behavior thing, here's a really scary stat, because my background is, I'm an organizer by background. Right. And, you know, one thing for me that always stuck out was one of the net effects of all of this, you know, not just fake news and disinformation, but harassment, was that if you go back and look in 2016, 44% of people that identified as left of center did not participate in posting or sharing things related to politics or civic engagement, or less likely to. That number was only 8% on the conservative side, meaning that people that identified as left of center were much less likely to actually stick their heads up and even talk about politics or civic engagement. And when you drill down to ask why, the big reason was they didn't want to be trolled, harassed, or abused. And that's where it starts to get into this murky stuff, because even the climate that these social media platforms can allow to take place, because they're either of bad enforcement or insufficient rules, can actually make it hard for people to feel comfortable engaging in the very basic aspects of participatory politics, and even harder to organize people. If people are too scared to say anything, it means that lies have a clearer landing strip, and that it's even harder to organize and engage folks. And so that's where I start to think, and where it starts to get into the more murky stuff, to your point. Well, and Facebook is totally off on that.
Let's take a break here. We'll get into some of those murky things when we come back, and we'll talk about potential solutions and another hearing that took place on the Hill this week that was less than substantive. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We are back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Right now I'm discussing congressional hearings involving Facebook and Twitter with the president of Media Matters, Angelo Carrizone. So, Angelo, when we broke, you were talking about these hearings with the CEOs of Facebook and Twitter that took place in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And you basically broke down, there were two sets of questions, some that were pretty low-hanging fruit and pretty cut and dry, others that start to get a little bit murky, like at what point do we start crossing the Rubicon where we are chilling free speech? And it strikes me, you know, that this is a very difficult, murky area in which to navigate, and that perhaps part of the problem is that it's really hard to come up with policies and expect them to be executed properly. And that the problem is that we're dealing with a distribution system in the internet that none of our concepts really are designed to deal with, right? When we talk about social media, and yep, that maybe the real problem is that we've allowed these things to become too dominant, that we, you know, it's equivalent to having just one TV network in some respects, which we would never have allowed in this country. And so I'm curious, to the extent that, and you're an expert at these type of questions of media, if the solution might be more along the lines in the same way that we don't allow excessive media concentration, that in some ways we shouldn't allow excessive social media concentration.
It's a good point. You know, I think that they, you know, one out of every two Americans right now uses their social media feed as their primary source of news. Not necessarily their exclusive source, but as their primary. That number will increase over time. And I think what makes it tough is, like, you know, as opposed to media more broadly or more traditionally, where it's a very one-directional, often one-directional kind of relationship. There's consumers, and then there's the broadcasters, and it's different. In this case, it's this weird thing where all the parties are different things at different times, right? Because part of the social media side of it is that it's social. We're all part of it. And what makes these platforms really powerful and have so much potential is that they are places of convening. One of the big downsides in the information landscape more broadly is the atomization, the fragmentation, which allows for, you know, more homogeny, increased consumption, you know, increased extremism, and people become isolated, and it's harder to reach people. And so, you know, the regulation side of it, I start to think about what are the implications if we were to break them up, and what does that mean long term, and is breaking up the only way to resolve or address some of these problems? Is it a concentration issue? Is it something else? And one thing that's pretty clear to me, and is that, yeah, I think there is a need for regulation. Regulation. It's been totally left off the table. What kind? I don't know if I have all the answers there, but one thing that is very apparent is there certainly needs to be some consistency in the rules of the game. So, for example, if you go back and look at, say, Google's role in distributing false information, fake news during the election cycle, less than 0.03% of traffic came from Google. And that's not because the fake content wasn't in Google search results. I mean, you just have to go to your 70th page of the results, because no one does that. That's because Google ranks their information in part based off of a whole range of factors: how long the website's been around for, how many other places are linking to it. You know, they have a source authority as a piece of how they tend to present information. Facebook doesn't have that at all. In fact, their only incentive is getting people to stay on the page longer and to engage with it, which is always going to move things further and further to the left or to the right. It literally will change our brain chemistry over time. It's like a drug. It's like sugar. It starts the response, the dopamine feedback loop that happens from that actually does shift the way people behave. And that's been totally unregulated. So put aside all the questions around how big the companies are and whether or not they should be so big and can we break them up. One thing that is very obvious at this stage of the game is that there are no rules for how a place that has so much agenda setting power, and that's really why we didn't want to have commercial monopolies around broadcasters in the past, was that you didn't want to have one entity have controlling the agenda. Is similar here, is that you have a place like Facebook, which has, you know, roughly 35% to 40% of the agenda setting power when it relates to our day-to-day conversations. And so I do think there's a lot of, and it was indicated even today in the hearing, that there's an intention to regulate a lot of this. And I think if we phase it in, some of the answers will become clearer as we start to delve into this. And one is obvious, that there does need to be some consistency in how these algorithms present information, because right now they're so ripe for manipulation and misinformation that we're having this conversation right now because, you know, the biggest company in the world still left itself a pretty big opening, and it was an intentional opening. It's a part of their business model, right? It's actually designed to be exploited like this because it's all based off of clicks as opposed to other factors and considerations. And at minimum, that seems to be the first order of business, is what are some of the ways in which your algorithm is both transparent, is taking into account other factors beyond engagement, and then lastly, how is it consistently adapting to identify anomalies or future threats so that you're not necessarily tricked or gamed like they were in 2016, or the countermeasures to protect.
Well, these are fascinating questions, and we may have to head down the road a little bit to find out what works to determine if we have the right answers. Angelo, though, I really appreciate your coming on and talking to us about it. We didn't have a chance to go into the shadow banning ridiculousness, but maybe we'll do that another time if anybody even hears us. Maybe we are being shadow banned. Angelo. Thanks again. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
Angelo Carrizone is the president of Media Matters. Coming up, judicial expert Dahlia Lithwick on the Kavanaugh hearings. I'm Sam Cedar. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Big story this week, of course, has been the drama centered around the congressional hearings on judicial nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Here to discuss what kind of justice we'd be getting if he's to be confirmed, Dahlia Lithwick, host of the podcast Amicus. So, Dahlia, obviously, hearings this week, confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh and join the Supreme Court. This is the 5-4 swing vote seat, I guess. And Anthony Kennedy was a swing vote, I guess, in, you know, parentheses, maybe with an asterisk on some things. Certainly when it came to a woman's right to choose, he was an important mitigating factor in the right's attempt to relieve women of that right. And in a couple of other areas, he may may prove to have been stopping the right wing assault on a series of other rights, not to mention other important doctrines, the Chevron doctrine. I want to get your sense, just broadly speaking, where is folks like yourself who, you know, have an intimate understanding of the law and of the Supreme Court. Where are you folks in terms of seeing this process, this nomination process, as legitimate? I mean, you know, I can't help but think, I mean, I've had this problem with the Supreme Court, frankly, since Bush v. Gore. But we're now entering, you know, even a darker period, it seems to me, where the process, never mind the way they adjudicate, the process seems to have been to have lost all legitimacy in some respects because of Merrick Garland.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think you can certainly carbon date it to Bush v. Gore. You can carbon date it, and I think Republicans do carbon date it to the Borking of Robert Bork. You know, it depends on where you want to set your sort of start clock. But I think that there has been a general consensus that the process is bad. It's getting worse. You know, the death of the filibuster, then the death of the filibuster last year for Neil Gorsuch. So it depends on what metric you're using. But I don't think you're wrong to say that everybody has completely lost confidence, not just in the idea of the court as a sort of impartial, apolitical arbiter of balls and strikes, but also how we even choose justices in the first instance. And I do agree also, I think, with the premise that if you can't get over Merrick Garland, and I can't because I don't think there was a principled reason to block him, then everything that comes after feels tainted. And we certainly saw that last year with Neil Gorsuch, where, you know, Democrats on the committee were just like, this is crazy. Why are we even here? And I don't think that's been alleviated. I think if you look at how the Kavanaugh hearings are playing out, just the amount of public disgust, the amount of protest we're hearing in the chamber, the amount of resistance and coordinated resistance – by Democrats in the Senate, I think absent what happened to Merrick Garland, nothing of the sort would be going on. So I think you're quite right that even if you bracket questions about Trump's legitimacy and whether he should be in a position to be picking a justice right now, those are a separate set of issues. I think you're completely right that it just feels like the process is so broken that everybody's lost confidence.
And I mean, I'm compelled to say that Merrick Garland was not blocked. Merrick, the issue, like, you know, the Republicans certainly could have voted against Merrick Garland, right? They had the votes if they wanted the votes. The issue is they never even gave him a hearing. And, you know, that to me seems, you know, you can, you know, they can compare it to what happened to Robert Bork. They can say, we don't like the way you voted in the hearing. We don't like the reason why you rejected Robert Bork. But there was not even a rejection of Merrick Garland here. There was a denial of the president's ability to even nominate, right? Because if you don't do a hearing, there is no nomination. If there's no opportunity to vote against the nominee, there is no nominee.
I think that's right. And I think you and I have talked about this in the past, Sam. I think that this was about power and not the Constitution. This was a determination by Chuck Grassley and by Mitch McConnell that he was simply not going to get a hearing or a vote. In many cases, he didn't even get courtesy meetings, and that was based on this pretextual argument that there's some kind of Biden rule that wasn't the Biden rule that said that you don't even get to appoint someone in your last year of your presidency, notwithstanding the fact that something like a third of presidents have appointed someone in their last year of their presidency. So the whole thing was a pretext. And you're quite right. They did it because they could. But here's the part that's really tricky. I think that Democrats that could have punished them at the ballot box for that behavior, and that was the expectation, that Democrats would be incensed that this seat had been held open for a year, that, you know, John McCain and Ted Cruz were openly running in the fall of 2016 on the principle that if Hillary Clinton were to win the presidency, they would hold that seat open for 4 or 8 more years, and Democrats failed to do the thing they needed to do to check that. And so I think in a weird way, this turns into a massive gamble that paid off, because Donald Trump said when he ran for office, he said, you're going to hold your nose and vote for me if for no other reason than I have a vacancy on the Supreme Court and you need me. And by about a 2-to-1 margin, voters showed up for him over Hillary Clinton. And so I think, you know, you're right to be affronted, but I also think that Democrats were completely complicit in letting it happen, and completely complicit, by the way, in failing to run for office in the Senate, particularly on the principle that this seat had been held open and that that was an affront. So I think it's just really complicated. They did it because they could, but I think in a sense Democrats let them.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. There was a political malpractice that extended from Barack Obama, as far as I'm concerned, through the Senate Democrats in their inability to make this an issue. And frankly, I would say there's a certain amount of malpractice on anyone on the left, you know, from the entire left that doesn't seem to appreciate the relevance of the Supreme Court. And we've certainly talked about that. So, okay, before we get into any of the specifics in terms of what Kavanaugh is dealing with and what the implications are going to be if he does make it to the court, with just a minute left before we got to take a break, do you think the Democrats should have walked out? Like, I mean, should they have even, based upon what we've just agreed upon, that there was a certain amount of political malpractice by the Democrats in not being able to hold to account, it's not even that they failed. It doesn't even feel like there was an attempt to hold anybody to account because of these, you know, their failure to hold hearings for Merrick Garland. Do you think they should have just en masse gotten up on day one and said, you know what, this is illegit, we're walking out? Or they should have done it because they didn't get the documents that were, you know, like were delivered for Elena Kagan, or that to the extent that they got any documents, they got them 12 hours before. In fact, I'll tell you what, Dahlia, let's take a break and we'll have you answer those long line of questions when we return. I'm Sam Seder. I'm talking to Dahlia Lithwick. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Right now I'm talking with the host of the Amicus podcast, Dahlia Lithwick, about the Kavanaugh hearings. So, Dahlia, before the break, I started to ask you one question. It turned into, I think, multiple premises. But the question was based upon how the Republicans denied President Obama even an opportunity to present a nominee in front of the Senate for the Supreme Court. And granted, we both agree there was a tremendous amount of political malpractice on behalf of Democrats in terms of holding the Republicans to account to this. Should the Democrats, based on either the Merrick Garland situation or on the fact that Chuck Grassley would not wait for hold up the hearings for documents to be produced that would give us insight to Brett Kavanaugh's behavior in the Bush White House, or the fact that to the extent that they delivered documents, they did it, 40,000 pages dumped 12 hours before day one of the hearing. Should the Democrats have even participated in this?
I mean, I think the short answer to the sort of complicated compound second question is any of those would have been a basis for the Democrats to say we're out. And if you watched sort of the first very contentious hour of the hearing on Tuesday morning when Chuck Grassley literally couldn't get a sentence out of his mouth without Democrats on the committee, you know, starting with Kamala Harris and Amy Klobuchar, Cory Booker, on down the line, incredibly concerted team effort by Democrats to make exactly the arguments that you're making, you know, the process arguments, which are you can't simply hide 90% of the documents that are relevant. Some of those documents were simply, you know, deemed privileged by the Trump White House without explanation. They're being vetted not by the National Archives, but by Bill Burke, a Republican lawyer who, by the way, once worked with Brett Kavanaugh. And
just some random Brett Kavanaugh friend,
right?
Is,
no, it's
deciding what's relevant to his.
Right. No,
his...
I mean it's crazy, and so I think any number of arguments, including by the way the very compelling argument that Senator Cory Booker's been making from the get-go, which is you cannot possibly tell us that a president who is an unindicted co-conspirator in you know what could be a major set of felony investigations is now appointing the person who will be the arbiter, who will be possibly the fifth vote one way or another. That has to be incorrect. Any number of those arguments, I think, would have been the basis to hold the thing up. And then you're just asking a really good tactical question that I don't know the answer to, which is, are you better off when Grassley refuses to adjourn or postpone the hearing until the documents come in? Do the Democrats just get up and walk out? I think they made the correct, in my view, tactical argument, which is you register the complaints and then you try to litigate the thing on the merits, that there's no intrinsic value to storming out and losing the vote anyway. And maybe, I mean, I guess I would ask you this question. If the end game really is we need to peel off a Susan Collins, we need to protect a Heidi Heitkamp, whatever the calculus is, if that's the end game, that we need to pick off a couple of Republicans, then arguably at least sitting there and trying to smoke out a real problem over a couple of days makes more sense than storming off. So I don't know the answer to that question, but it seems to me that there was at least some basis by which to say we have enough here that it's worth going through the motions, even if it means putting a sort of imprimatur of legitimacy on these proceedings.
Right. And I have to agree. I mean, I think you've got to hang in there. And to a certain extent, if you're going to do it over Merrick Garland, you do that during the Neil Gorsuch hearing, which is really where you had to make that stand. All right. Well, so with that said, I've got to ask you about this. The Manny Miranda line of questioning from Patrick Leahy, because it seems to me that the only way, and you mentioned Susan Collins and maybe Lisa Murkowski, that's the end game. But the only way you get to the end game is if you keep the Joe Manchins and the McCaskills and the Doug Jones and the Joe Donnellys and the Heidi Heitkamps in line first. And the only way you keep them, it seems to me, is to make it about something that's non-ideological, that it's a process question, that maybe the guy's perjured himself or he's unfit in some manner. And the idea that there are documents that seem to indicate that Brett Kavanaugh has not been fully truthful in either past trips in front of the Judiciary Committee or just broadly in terms of his role in receiving stolen information back during the aughts when he worked for the Bush administration. That to me seems like the best place to fish if you're looking to catch fish, as it were. And I'm just curious as to how much do you think that that resonates?
You know, it's hard to tell. I was watching it pretty carefully on Wednesday, and I will say that I think that Senator Leahy really caught him flat-footed. It was clear that Kavanaugh wasn't prepared. It was clear that as the colloquy went on, Kavanaugh was more and more worried that he was inching his way into a perjury trap, that he had said explicitly, I didn't get these stolen documents from Manny Miranda, and here's Leahy, you know, pulling them out and waving them around. And so I think that there is a way in which just the optics of exactly what you've just described, did you at some point lie to this committee, are you lying now, is pretty bad. I think the other thing that it did, and I think you alluded to this, is it really concretized this issue of the documents. Because up until that moment, this idea that, oh, we only got 7% out of the hundreds and thousands of pages of documents that are relevant, we got 7%, just seemed like a really nitpicky abstract idea. And suddenly there is this principled thing, which is, oh, this is why the documents matter, because you were intimately involved with questions about detainee torture, about black sites. You were intimately involved, this is what the Democrats are alleging, with, you know, passing off hacked and stolen documents in order to get judges confirmed. And so it materialized in a really, I think, important way why the documents should be salient, and that this isn't just nitpicking or, you know, sort of slow walking, that this matters. And I think in that sense, that was it could be the thing that makes the documents seem relevant and material, and that he is hiding them. And it allowed, I think, Leahy and then later Dick Durbin to ask these really relevant questions about, don't you want us to know? Don't you want to clear your name? It would seem that it's in your interest, Judge Kavanaugh, to have these documents come out. And I think that matters a little. I would say the other thing that I thought was really important that happened Wednesday were the direct questions about, can you tell us if the president can pardon himself? Can you tell us if you believe that the president can't be investigated? His utter refusal to answer any of those questions may be the way you pick off somebody who is undecided. The idea, again, that he is declining to even opine on the scope of presidential immunity, or, you know, can the president, if he's bribing people, if he's deliberately obstructing, is that something you want to talk about? And his just declared statement that there is no way he can offer thoughts on any of that, I think may be salient in a way that is hard for us to understand sort of in the heat of battle.
Right. I mean, this isn't, I mean, these are fairly, it seems to me to be, and we just, I guess we got to wrap up now, but those questions about whether a president can be subpoenaed seems to me to be, you know, we're talking about civil procedure here, right? We're not talking, this is not, you don't need a lot of facts, it seems to me, to make that assessment, which his trying to sell that this is a hypothetical seems a little bit tough to swallow. But Dahlia Lithwick, thank you so much for walking us through this. I guess we'll get a better sense in the next couple of days as to what the Senate's going to do.
Thanks for having me.
Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus. Hey, that's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. I want to say thank you to everyone who's taken the time to support this show by becoming a member of our podcast. If you aren't a member, do us both a favor. Help support independent media. Go to ROFpodcast.com. For just a couple of bucks a week, you get the full show without commercials. That's the best way to support Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. Check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream covering all the biggest news stories of the day. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire Radio.